You may not be instantly familiar with cultural visionary Allie Willis, but the songs she wrote just may be on your iPod. Allie's hit songs have sold over 50 million records, including Earth, Wind & Fire's Boogie Wonderland, the Pointer Sisters' Neutron Dance, and the Pet Shop Boys' What Have I Done to Deserve This? Allie even won an Emmy for her number one hit, I'll Be There for You, the theme from Friends, and a Tony for the Broadway musical version of The Color Purple. But one of her most unusual musical projects was discovering the Del Rubio Triplets, the blonde go-go boot-wearing guitar trio in real-life Triplets, who became the toast of the late 80s camp scene for their funky appearances on The Golden Girls, Married with Children, and Pee-wee's Christmas Special.
You can feel Allie's influence over the music and television of the 80s, but in the early 1990s, she had the bright idea of bringing the music industry onto the internet by starting an online social network. The music industry didn't bite. Listen as Allie Willis shares with us stories of her incredible career, her online museum of kitsch, and her upcoming collaborations.
The secret history of the Del Rubio Triplets.
Her fearless alter ego, Bubbles, the bad artist.
What the music industry can do to survive.
And what is the real meaning of the song Neutron Dance?
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun. Today's show is brought to you by generous support of fantastic people like you. We count on your support. Thank you. Feast of Fun is also made possible by our friends at lifelube.org, your gay, sexy, healthy spot on the net.
Gay men's health is about everything. Your body, your mind, and spirit.
LifeLube delivers daily news and commentary on gay men's health issues with wit, whimsy, hairy daddies, kooky queens, sparkly fairies, and Peter Pointers.
Need health pointers? Ask Peter. Peter Pointers is LifeLube's gay health educator, assisted by specialists on call to answer your health questions.
Ask for Peter Pointers. Visit LifeLube.org. Before we start, let's listen to the Del Rubio Triplets' quirky cover of Allie Willis' song, Neutron Dance, the song she originally wrote for the Pointer Sisters for the film Beverly Hills Cop 2. This version is from the Del Rubio Triplets' album, Three Gals, Three Guitars.
Take it anymore. I'll just stay here locked behind the door. There's no time to stop and get away. Gotta work so hard to make it every day. Falling from the sky, 'cause a man took my heart and robbed me blind. Someone stole my brand new Chevrolet, and the rent is due, and I got no place to stay. Ooh, ooh. And it's hard to say just how some things never change. Dance. Oh, I'm just burning doing the neutron dance.
Austin, Austin, Texas, at the height of South by Southwest.
That's right.
With the queen of kitsch, Allie Willis.
That's right. Hello.
You may not know her, but you certainly love her music for years and generations. She's composed some of the most fun and exciting songs. Let's go through some of these. Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Tons of Earth, Wind, and Fire. I wrote, my very first hit was September.
Yeah. Do you remember?
Yeah. Remember.
And there was Boogie Wonderland.
Ain't no R on that, remember.
Remember.
Boogie Wonderland, the whole I Am album, except for I did not write After the Love Is Gone.
Yeah.
I do have to say that if you hear music bleeding through on this, this is so not my music.
This is Austin. It's spring break. Everybody's having a party. Everywhere you go, you can't escape it.
You can't escape it. It's like the music is in the background.
Right, but it is such inappropriate music for my interview. However, let's see, what else? Neutron Dance by the Pointer Sisters. I have a Grammy for Beverly Hills Cop. For Neutron Dance and Stir It Up, Patti LaBelle. What Have I Done to Deserve This? Pet Shop Boys. I wrote the theme to Friends, the TV series.
I'll be there for you.
I wrote The Color Purple musical I co-wrote.
That's just most recently.
Yeah.
And yet, for me personally, the most important musical contribution you have given me personally is the Del Rubio triplets.
Absolutely.
These wonderful Panamanian-born triplets.
Ooh, you have done your research.
Oh, I love
them. Been a big fan for years.
Wow.
Yeah. I played that cassette tape over. That's how, you know, back that was 1989. I had that cassette tape and I just absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And, you know, their song, people might remember the Del Rubio triplets from Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special, where they sang Winter Wonderland.
Right.
But they were everywhere. They're on the Golden Girls.
Here's what happened. My boyfriend at the time, his agent had a flyer on his wall, and I have always been into bad music. My music I do consider good.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've co-written with everyone from Bob Dylan on down. But I was so fascinated by kind of the bottom feeder class of music because and the Del Rubios, if you don't know, they sang fairly out of tune, but perfectly in tune with each other. They were at that time 75-year-old, identical, completely identical triplets with massive blonde bouffants,
and white go-go
bouffants, go-go boots, and mini skirts, fully, you know, costumes that they made themselves every night. They had one martini every night, and they sewed, and they arranged their songs on a little plastic keyboard that the keys no longer worked on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would tap out arrangements that no one but them could hear. And because I said, unglue the keys, let's hear. And they said, oh no, we can hear perfectly. So I never questioned them on anything because it made it even more insane.
Because now they were always performing and when you approached them.
Well, my boyfriend saw a flyer on his agent's wall. And he brought it home because it said, three gals, three guitars. We play 375 different kinds of music. And who the hell knew there were 375 different kinds of music? And so I took one look at them and I called them up. And as luck would have it, they were playing at a party in Hollywood. It was very close to my house. And I took my friend Katie Segal, who then got known for being Peg Bundy on Married with Children, Futurama, and she just got an Emmy for Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah.
And
you took Peg
me
Bundy.
Me and Peg Bundy
went to see the Del Rubios,
and their dressing room, I swear to God, was porta potty.
It was a
triple wide porta potty. So we go knock at the door of the porta potty because that's where people said they were, and the door opened and literally the breath was knocked out of me. If I had not been with her, I would have had a broken neck because I fell back. It was like you ever got out of a car like in Palm Springs where it's 400 degrees.
Hot, yeah.
It literally knocks the breath out of you and pushes you back in the car. That's what happened. And they had these little pink mini skirts and the Go-Go Boots, and then we stayed and watched them play, and I fell in love with them. And my song, Neutron Dance, had just come out by the Pointer Sisters. And I said to them, if you will learn this song, I'm having a very large party. It was 2,000 people. And I will present you. So I had a party downtown. I opened a, it wasn't my club, but I threw the opening night party. It was called the Stock Exchange. And we were up on a balcony that was like 20 feet in the air.
Yeah.
Which means that 2,000 people were looking up the Del Rubio's mini skirts. And literally.
How old are they at this time?
75.
75.
I think 75. They told me, I asked how old they were. They said 40. But then again, I asked Millie, who's the last surviving one, a couple of years ago. I didn't ask how old she was. It came up in conversation. She said, well, you know, I'm almost 70 now. And it's like, I don't think so. But I don't, you have, you know, I let them go.
Where is Millie right now?
At an undisclosed location that only me and a couple other people know about.
Didn't want any visitors?
No, she, you know, once the first one passed away, which was in 1996, I gave both of the eulogies and had the memorials at my place. They truly, I always said they were one person with three heads.
Yeah.
And that is literally what they were.
They never performed again after one of them died.
Not only wouldn't perform again, put the guitars in the closet and they never came out again. We got her, well, the first one passed away in, 96, 4 years later, the second one passed away. They were born 15 minutes apart, and they also passed away, though one is still surviving, in the order they were born. And the oldest one, who was only half an hour older than the youngest one, the oldest one was truly the oldest sister, and the youngest one was truly the youngest. Like the youngest one,
like
Millie was the least capable of functioning alone, basically. And they did everything in that order. So they stood on stage with the oldest one on the right, and I don't know, right from left. The oldest one on the left. Do me a favor, shoot from there too.
Oh yeah, we're also doing this in simulcast for your Kitsch Art Museum.
Well, Allie Willis Museum of Kitsch, awmok.com, which we'll talk about later. But though the Del Rubios are the cornerstone. So they did everything in that order. They slept in the same bed in that order. They went to the bathroom in the morning in that order. The Go-Go Boots were in that order.
Can I ask, did they ever date?
No.
In that order?
Well, one of them dated and was going to get married. By the way, no sex ever.
So the three of them were virgins?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they, well, yeah, I guess they did, yeah.
So she didn't get married? What happened?
No, because they realized it would break up the act. So they decided that she was not going to get married, and then that was it, and they never thought about it
again. The remaining one, is she in good health? Is she doing well?
Not really.
Not fantastic.
For Valentine's Day, though, you had all your readers of your blog send her Valentine's Day cards. What was her reaction when she got this bucket?
I did that with a site called Hidden Los Angeles that quite a few years ago had people write birthday cards to her. And I did that in conjunction with them. We got almost 1,000 cards, most of them homemade. They were unbelievable. And that thrilled her. Because she doesn't think that people remember who they were. And they, out of everyone I know, they wanted to be stars more than Lady Gaga wanted to be stars.
Really?
And they were stars in their own kind of universe.
I have to say, in the DNA of this show and our website, the Del Rubio Triplets and that album was so influential to me because it allowed me to take a look at popular culture and own it in a way that felt very distant from me as a young gay boy and as a consumer. They gave the idea, especially with Sandra Bernhardt and Pee Wee Herman and the Del Rubio Triplets, that you could take popular culture, mix it up a bit, and focus on its quirky, colorful side and own it.
Well, also, I mean, those, Sandra and Paul at that time were like really close friends of mine. I mean, everyone kind of came out of this, didn't come out of the same clique, but were in the same kind of show business clique, which was definitely, you know, many people had success, but you were, it was a very individual success. There wasn't another one like you in the bunch, you know?
And so how did a Native American and sort of like the whole Hopi Anasazi and the focus of that South Four Corners art impact on all you guys? Because one example is on the floor of Pee Wee's Playhouse, there's a Hopi Indian like symbol.
That you got to ask him. I don't know anything about
In terms of like
Kitsch
culture and the Del Rubio triplets, I feel like they were all very much interconnected and one fed into the other.
Yeah, we, all of us from different viewpoints loved Kitsch, but I think my definition, and I would, theirs is very similar. It definitely differs from the standard definition of Kitsch. I think if you look up Kitsch in the dictionary, and I will say that I was the definition of Kitsch in dictionary.com for many years, but the standard, the, if you were going to go to Webster's dictionary, it's very kind of overwrought, in bad taste a lot. You know, George and Martha Washington sculptures with marble, you know.
Overly cute things.
Yeah, my Kitsch is not that. My definition of it is largely sprung from pop culture.
Yeah.
Things that either became so massively popular but were very individual visions. And I always use the example of the Pet Rock.
Mm-hmm.
In today's thing, the Snuggie. You know, things that, who, developing them, if you had an idea to paint a face on a rock or whatever and put it in a little crate, most people would have said you were crazy. But you had this vision and ha-ha, joke is on everyone else. These people made trillions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know?
Yeah.
Why do you think that captured everybody's imagination? Like,
Because it was, well, somehow it caught on, mm-hmm. and it was like the thing to have. And who had ever done anything like that? It just, it was so 70s, you know, to do that. But I also, it would be something that was very trendy, a Dr. Mm-hmm. Kildare game, or you know, I love pop culture. So, but my favorite aspect of pop culture would be more like the Del Rubios, where it combines something that is kind of had legitimate success. In my case, let's say Neutron Dance. What have I had done to deserve this? Devo, Whip It. You know. But then did it in such a way that no one else could have ever possibly done. It was such an individual arrangement of that song. It was an insane arrangement of the song, but it was so charming and endearing now, because they loved what they did.
Did they do the arrangement themselves, or did you collaborate with them?
Oh, no, that is all them on the silent keyboard that they all magically heard.
Were they a hard group to manage?
Well, I was not a legitimate manager. It wasn't like here, sign a deal. And they did have a couple people that they worked with as closely as they worked with me. I was just the one that was always throwing the parties and booking them at things. And I was lucky enough to have enough hit songs at that moment or over those years where I could, you know, I had the legitimate hit, and then I had the Del Rubio
the
one.
Camp
so
version.
Mine was kind of more public, but they had a couple people that worked kind of closely with them. But,
were the
you know,
Pointer Sisters comfortable, or the Pet Shop Boys comfortable with their songs being reinterpreted in this way?
Well, those are probably the two most apt discussions. Pet Shop Boys were obsessed with the Del Rubios. That was one of the first things that they liked about me. And they always wanted to do a duet with them, and it just never worked out that anyone was in the States at the same time. Pointer Sisters, that was the very first song of mine that they did. And Neutron Dance. And they sang it within 2 weeks of me meeting them the first time. And the most amazing thing about this is we're standing up on this 20-foot balcony, and I see all this commotion going back. This club was almost a block long. I mean, it was huge. And I didn't know what it was, but I heard, you could kind of hear a roar happening from the back of the place. And Del Rubios are singing the song, and I see the crowd kind of parting, and I see this huge mass of hair, and I realize it's Ruth Pointer, who sang the lead on Neutron Dance. And I just thought, literally, the greatest moment of my career is about to happen, because it's going to be the best with the worst. And that's what I like doing. Take the high, take the low, combine them. That's it. She came on stage. And you had to walk up a winding staircase to get on stage. And the song, I think, was number two at that time. And the Pointer Sisters were so huge. So the crowd was going fucking nuts, you know? And it was a dance club, and they were huge in dance clubs at that time. Dance club.
So everybody, it was the universal reaction of love and appreciation.
They thought it, I mean, Ruth, she thought it was funny. And that is online, by the way. I mean, no one knows it's online. I just stuck it up a couple weeks ago.
Right. Let's talk about the song, The Neutron Dance. Because a lot of people, what is it? A neutron bomb is something that destroys all the people but saves all the technology.
Okay, well, first of all, let me say so the hook line in that song is, you know, I'm just burning doing the neutron dance.
I'm so happy doing the burning.
I don't know my own songs.
Well, yes, right?
So, yeah, I never know
burning. And he goes, it's happy, I said.
No, it's
I'm
both.
So happy.
Okay.
It's I'm both. Just burning. It's actually, yeah. I'm so happy.
I'm so happy I'm burning the neutron.
I wrote that. Well, okay. That is the song more than anything that spreads across more areas of my life than you can imagine. It was originally written for a film called Streets of Fire.
Yes, love that film.
I wrote it with a guy named Danny Cimbello. He had never written before, but his brother was Michael Cimbello, and Maniac was massive.
The bodybuilder, too, at the time.
Yeah,
a bodybuilder pop star.
Yeah, yeah. So Danny got a publishing deal because Michael was huge. And Danny played keyboard for Stevie Wonder, forever. And he was really young. He was like 18 when we wrote that song. And we wrote it in half an hour. I'm going to get to that. I'm going to get to that. It took about a half an hour to write. And we were supposed to be writing a song for Streets of Fire that is about like a nuclear holocaust. And there's, you know, five people left on Earth.
Real
the attractive guy, girl, and a black singing group, like a 50s black singing group. So the assignment was to write a song that could take place where this black group was in the back of a bus, of course, and the young couple's up front, and what's the black group singing while the bus is trying to hightail it out of town? So the hook line was originally, I'm just burning on the barbecue. The original name of the song was Barbecue. And I knew that wasn't right. It just didn't feel right. And I don't know how Neutron Dance came into my head, but it came into my head.
Proton Dance or
no, Neutron, I don't know what it was. It was like the second that came in. And it was about 3 weeks after we had the whole song written.
Because it had kind of, the word new. In its
I don't know what it was. It just felt, and it sang right. It sang a lot better than Proton Dance. That doesn't fall into the groove, you know? Nor does Electron.
Gist of it is like how I learned to stop worrying and love the bomb?
No, it had nothing to do with any of that. To me, and this is what every single song of mine is about, if you actually read the lyric, if your life isn't working, change your fucking life. You know, and let me also say I was named one of the most dangerous subversives living in the United States by the communist government, by Pravda, which was the official newspaper, because they mistranslated it as neutron bomb. And they said that they singled me out with Prince and said we were the two most dangerous people in rock and roll. Him for Purple Rain, that they said was synonymous with nuclear fallout.
Because they felt that these songs glorified or made Americans comfortable with the idea of nuclear war.
No, because we had such access to youth, we were preaching the inevitability of nuclear war. And I had done a People magazine interview, and they I had paraphrased what the song was about. Which was basically, you know, again, if your life isn't working, do something. And ultimately, who cares if you have no money and you have no car and you have no romance? Just dance. I mean, it's up to you. Are you going to be depressed or are you going to be happy and celebrate life? And so the first act, the real verse of Neutron Dance is, I don't want to take it anymore. I'll just stay here locked behind the door. Just no time to stop and get away because I work so hard to make it every day. Ooh, ooh. It's hard to find any strength. It's hard to say just why some things never change. It's hard to find any strength to draw the line. I'm just burning doing the neutron dance. That was translated into a powerful nuclear explosion is approaching. It will annihilate everyone. Who cares if you have no car, no money, no romance, just dance, dance, dance. So they said it was a very flippant attitude to have. And it criticized me for my subversive friends. And they singled out Pee Wee Herman and Patti LaBelle because of her hair, which was this massive pyramid at the time.
What was subversive about that hair?
They didn't like it. I don't know.
This is Russia or People magazine? This,
no, Pravda, which was the official, yeah. It was a huge article.
But that song was, I mean, were you surprised how big that song was? That song
Was in Beverly Hills Cop. And that movie was so huge. And let me just throw in... Mm-hmm. That Eddie Murphy, throughout the film, wore a t-shirt that said Mumford on it. Mm-hmm. And that was my high school, which I didn't know any of this when I wrote it, that I was somehow linked. Mm-hmm. Jerry Bruckheimer, it ends up, also went to Mumford, which I didn't know at the time. And so Neutron Dance got very associated with this school because it's an inner city mm-hmm. high school. It's the biggest high school in Detroit. Underprivileged, mostly, you know, kids go there. And... but wonderful kids. So I am actually going back to Detroit in 3 weeks to conduct my high school marching band in the lobby of the theater that I grew up in, doing Neutron Dance, doing like 7 of my like biggest hits with the cast of The Color Purple singing along because The Color Purple is going to be there. So I feel like, you know, Neutron Dance more than any song has just... It's provided me with the craziest experiences because the Del Rubio sang it because I was named a Dangerous Subversive because it was a huge hit record because I got a Grammy for it. And it's like the high school theme song and now it's tying into Color Purple and it makes me so happy.
How's I'm Neutron Dance tying to the Color Purple?
Because they're going
to
sing
because
it.
Because Color Purple is in town. And the high school now is 99% black, 99% underprivileged. And I don't know any story in the world that is more about black underprivileged than The Color Purple.
Yeah.
And it is about taking, you know, really dealing with your life and becoming a very proud, happy person. It is exactly what Neutron Dance is about. You know,
how did you come up to be picked or how, tell us about the discussion that went in and getting you involved on the Color Purple musical.
I had been very, very good friends for at least 20 years. It was actually Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman that introduced me to this guy named Scott Sanders, mm-hmm. who became CEO of Radio City at like 21 years old. He's credited with bringing Radio City back after it was closed for so many years because he brought Liberace in 1981. He was a college promoter at that time, and he convinced Radio City that he could sell out Radio City if they would let him bring Liberace in. So he created this whole career for himself. And I met, actually, Paul brought Scott Sanders to the set of the first music video that I like did all the sets for and everything. It was a group called Breakfast Club. They were Madonna's backup band.
Yeah.
They had a hit song called Right on Track. I did that video. And the one of the members of Breakfast Club was Stephen Bray, who I wrote The Color Purple with, along with Brenda Russell and Marsha Norman. So I met Stephen and Scott on the same day in 1987. Cut ahead to 20 years later, Scott Sanders calls me up. He said, I bought the rights to The Color Purple. You know, come have dinner with me. And at that point, I had dropped out for almost a decade from, the last song I wrote was the Friends theme, which was 1994. Yeah. So now here we are in 1998, 99. So I thought, oh, he's going to ask me to write The Color Purple. That would be unbelievable. And, you know, me, who I love black culture more than anything in the world. I'm white and Jewish, by the way. and a girl, in case you couldn't hear from my voice.
So he asked you to do
No, it. He did not ask me okay. to do it. He said, I'm going to give you the name of two songwriters. Tell me which one should write The Color Purple. Neither one of them were appropriate. They were wildly inappropriate. So I gave him my opinion, and I told him which one I thought he should hire if he was actually going to do it. And he did, and they had the gig for about a year. And then he called me up again. I mean, we were talking in that time. But and I thought, now he's going to ask me to write it. I mean, I'm like a natural choice. Look at the songs I've written. And he said, I'm going to bounce the name of 50 songwriters off of you. And now I'm going to make people audition. So just say yes, no to these writers. Like, let's pick 10, basically. And he finally got to the name Brenda Russell. She's a spectacular songwriter. She wrote Get Here by Aaliyah Adams, sure. Luther Vandross, If Only for One Night, like a you know, bunch of stuff. And she was actually on her way over to my house to score an animated thing that I had done with my partner, Prudence Fenton. It was called Fat Girl. And he got to Brenda Russell, and I said, well, what would you feel like if we co-wrote? And he said, fine, but no special favors. And it was like, no special favors? You haven't thought of me for two fucking years. I don't expect a favor, you know? So, and so we were scoring this animated thing, also with Stephen Bray. And he wrote and produced Respect Yourself, Get Into the Groove, like that whole Madonna period. And so we competed. And the only advantage we had was that I picked the people we competed against. But I really did it, honestly. Like, of this group of 50 writers, who could really nail it?
And nailed it.
And we nailed it.
Now, over the internet with Lady Gaga's, everything goes back to Lady Gaga, right? These days, with Lady Gaga's Born This Way, there's a huge controversy over that it sounds too derivative or similar to Madonna's Express Yourself, even though that song was very derivative
of a thousand other songs. But I mean, I can't actually, I don't really know what's happening, but I do know that a bunch of songwriters, before I even heard the Lady Gaga song, emailed me and said, you have to call Steven right away and because he's got a lawsuit. And, you know, needless to say, if you can get a piece of a Lady Gaga record, that's pretty good.
Well, because musicians do pay people off a lot of times. You just don't even know about it.
Oh,
right?
I can't tell you how often that happens. It's up to you to hear it and then go after someone, literally.
Was there
but
a secret
I don't know
deal?
That they're, I don't know that they are doing anything about it.
I suspect there is a secret deal. Just the fact that Lady Gaga winks so much at the camera. I mean, she accepts her Grammy and she wants to thank Whitney Houston for inspiring
her
in this
way. Do you get that?
No. As a songwriter, is that even plausible?
Yeah, and Whitney Houston was born into music royalty because of her mom. So, I mean, that born this way, yeah, I wouldn't mind being born that way, you know? Talk about getting Clive Davis to hear you easily. That's crazy. Now, by the way, I have video footage of Clive Davis auditioning the Del Rubio triplets after I called him up to tell him that I had made my most significant talent find ever, and we along with my friend Jim Budman took them to Clive's bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And when he opened the door and saw them standing there, as he hugged me, he whispered, I'll kill you.
Because what was he expecting?
But we videoed the whole audition, and they did Besame Mucho, Neutron Dance, and Whip It.
Where is a documentary filmmaker to turn this into a film?
Well, I have all the footage.
Are you going to turn it into a movie?
Well, we're actually talking about with Mark over there.
Mark's filming us right now.
Mark
Blackwell,
right now.
Hi, Mark. Who I work with. That when I go to Detroit for the high school thing, and I'm also a closing keynote speaker at a huge conference about the rejuvenation of Detroit, and I love Detroit more than any place, except maybe Los Angeles.
What do you think about the RoboCop statue?
I don't know about the RoboCop
statue. Oh, my
statue.
God. People have raised hundreds of thousands
half
of
a million? Was it half a million or 50,000? 50,000.
I think it was about a significant amount of money and caused a lot of controversy because they're like, This could go to rejuvenate and beautify the city instead of building a RoboCop statue. And everyone's like, that is beautifying the city.
I don't even know about it. I tell you, who should be glorified in that city is a woman named Martha Jean, the Queen, who was the most instrumental DJ that ever came out of Detroit. And she kind of paralleled the rise of Motown. And she was the first, she's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She was the first ever female owner of a radio station, which was in Memphis. Then moved to Detroit, was a DJ at both of the black radio stations there, WJLB, WCHB, and is credited with quieting the city down in the 1967 riots because she stayed on the air for 48 hours. And that's who deserves that statue.
Will there be a Del Rubio Triplets documentary?
I don't think there will be a Del Rubio's documentary so much as I have all the footage and it would certainly be in my documentary. But in terms of theirs, there's, I don't know. I mean, they had, they kept very pristine scrapbooks and everything. And we don't know where that stuff
there's
is
there's a movie
now.
There, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
So make it happen.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about, because I saw you speak this morning at South by Southwest Interactive on a panel on collaboration. And but you also mentioned that you have an alter ego, Bubbles the Artist, because you want to make bad art.
Absolutely. Well, Bubbles supported me for many years. That happened in 1999. I had stopped doing music for most of the 90s because I, in 1991, someone showed me the internet and I went, that's it. So I developed a social network starting in 1992.
1992, you did develop the concept of a social network.
Yes. It was actually called Willisville. And it was, you know, at that time in cyberspace, you could do email over here. And then if you wanted to play a game, it would take you 10 minutes. Oh, my God. It would take you 10 minutes. Don't even ask about that ding. 10 minutes to log off and go play a game.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to log off and go to the one store that had shopping. So the idea was, first of all, take all of these online experiences, put them into one place. Create an entirely new kind of interactive entertainment where the story actually surrounded the community. And it was all about basically social directing cyberspace. What did it look like? What did it sound like? What did it feel like? What were the party games that went on? What, you know, what kind of... connecting
with
each other.
Were you aware enough of the limitations of the technology at
yes,
the time?
But because I have always been into kitsch, I didn't give a shit if it was an all text thing.
But you were also worried about copyright infringement and also privacy concerns.
Well, that I would, the reason that we didn't, well, there were several reasons why we didn't get it off the ground. But one very primary reason was I knew in order for it to work that people would be stealing each other's work and posting each other's, you know, photos and videos and music, and that there was going to be no compensation, no way to protect the primary author of that work. And then there were privacy issues, and no one knew the way around that. So it became exhausting with me and my partners, one of which was Prudence Fenton, who I just mention. She was the animation and special effects director for Pee-wee's Playhouse. She was the co-creator and producer of those early Peter Gabriel videos.
Oh, wow.
Brought Beavis and Butthead to MTV. You must know Liquid Television.
Of course.
Yeah. So that was her show. She created that show and then found all the pieces that went on that show. The character Penny is based on her. And she
Penny?
Yeah, when screened Penny again, the collective oohs and ahs of that audience.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Ali, you and your friends have been single-handedly responsible for some of the most memorable and joyful experiences of my generation.
Well, the really off-key ones,
I think
do you guys know Pygmy Will?
No, I
don't. Oh, my God.
Who's Pygmy Will?
Pygmy, well, no, you wouldn't.
Maybe.
I mean, four
people
know.
I'll have to
Google
it, but the internet connection went down.
Oh, no. Pygmy Will is something that Prudence and I do together, and she was also the voice of the flowers in the flower box. I can't do it.
Over here, Pygmy.
Yeah. So Pygmy Will kind of has that voice. It's the most poorly drawn animated character you could ever imagine, and we post twice a day. There are 30 or 40 animations, but every day we do little still frames, and he's just a little short guy whose best friend is a palm tree named Feathers. And there's another one more character called Wiska, who is just a pineapple on a tricycle. And but Pygmy Will is the eternal optimist. Like he just, you know, it's someone who makes lemonade out of lemons. So go to YouTube.
Is that a PC term? I don't
know. No, not that look at me. Is anything PC?
So, I mean, throughout, you know, because you've been so influential, you've written all these songs, you've brought all this culture, you decided to have a museum dedicated to Kitsch.
Well,
but really it's a museum of, your life.
It's a, and it's a social network, but based around a very specific interest. In the real world, I have, as far as I know, the largest collection of pop culture and soul Kitsch. Soul Kitsch, I should just divert for a minute. I worked a lot with James Brown. Mm-hmm. And when he saw my collection, he very specifically said about the black stuff. The black stuff would be a bingo game, let's say, but instead of B-I-N-G-O, it's B-L-A-C-K. And the, you know, instead of numbers, it's like chitlins and gold tooth and, you know, things like that. Down to, you know, all the kind of black popular little dolls that, you know, instead of the Farrah doll, it was the God, you know, just things that were...
If it was black, you had it.
If it was black, and if it came out of pop culture and very specifically very large afros and the incredible pimp suits and stuff like that, isn't that nice from who the person that wrote The Color Purple musical? But that it's like my hair, short on one side, long on the other. It is what I love. Oh, but James Brown said there was no money to distribute these products. So please continue collecting these because no one has that this kind of stuff amassed in one place.
Well, Whoopi Goldberg has a lot, too.
She has, though, from what I understand, a lot of Mammy's, Sambo's. Yeah. That is not what my stuff is.
Yours is like Super Soul Saturday
Super
stuff.
Soul 70s music, you know, like very, it's different. It's not, it's
Cleopatra
newer.
Jones and.
Yes, die for. So.
And so people can go to this museum and so visit, like,
online,
buy a chip, or is it all online?
Well, no, the museum is actually my place, which was built as the party house for MGM in 1937.
I want to visit this, your place.
Trust me, you want to visit this place.
I want to visit L.A., right?
In L.A., yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, next time we're in Los Angeles, do
absolutely.
You promise
I
to give us a tour?
After being in this house, are you kidding? Absolutely.
So we're taping this out of my mom's house. And I could not think of a more appropriate fit of a location for us to interview.
No, I literally, it was like, you know, we thought, oh, we're going to someone's house and, you know, and then the second that door opened, it was like, I am home.
I see this house as very Texas. To me, it feels very Texas.
See, and I don't know Texas. Mm-hmm. This is my first
day.
Well,
the thing about it is people in Southern towns, especially women of my mother's generation. Of course, my mother went to high school with Terrence McNally. It was all
incredible.
Part of that whole, you know, University of Texas, English writers.
Educated
mm-hmm. scene. But there's a profound, because of the Mexican culture and the Native American culture coming here, there's this sort of like fetishism about color and about unusual little objects.
Well, and a lot of family memories. Yeah. And I might say that it's March and the Christmas decorations are still up,
they
which
never
is,
go
makes
down.
Me so happy.
They never go down here. I think Christmas, listen, if you love Christmas so much, Mark actually makes us
I don't
take
like
down.
Christmas. I like Christmas decorations.
I like Christmas decorations too.
Yeah.
And for me, it's like in Puerto Rico, I'll give you a little story. We would scream as kids not to take down the Christmas tree. My birthday is in April.
So you had it until then?
My mother had to take down the Christmas tree because she was worried that they were going to think we were insane because the kids were going to come over to my house in April.
Yeah.
And we still had a Christmas tree with full decorations still up by April. My father, we would take the Christmas tree out to the backyard and, you know, Latin Americans do this. They set it on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the police and the firemen came thinking that the house was on
fire. Oh, because
they
don't know what it was.
Well, because it was April. But if you burn your Christmas tree back in the 1970s, in January maybe, people understand what
Yeah, they knew
doing.
What it was. They were ready for it.
Now, let me ask you, because we're taping this podcast, of course, so people can listen to it, but you actually have your own tape recorder here.
You're recording.
You, you record every conversation you have.
Yeah. If I don't, it's only because I'm lazy, but since it started in 1978 when the video camera first came out, that sounds like I was around when the automobile was invented. But... And so I became obsessed with trying to at least get significant moments of my life on tape. And then I realized that it was actually the insignificant moments that kind of were the most interesting when I would go back and look. So, you know, I'm not only audio taping it, we're also videotaping.
And what are you doing with all this documentation? Because it's not always easily accessible.
Yeah. I mean, I always said I was the original reality show. Because I do have most of my life from that point on. What I don't have on tape, which is so completely stupid, I don't even have photographs. That whole period when my songwriting career took off, I have nothing. I don't have one photo with Earth, Wind, and Fire. I don't have, you know, I don't know
they're
what
still around.
It was.
You can go and have a photo with them.
Not, they're not only are they still around, they're one of the top touring bands in the world to this day. You know?
Well, I mean, have they ever like say, come up onto the stage with us?
Well, my goal after conducting my high school, I went to University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I went back. They asked me to come back for homecoming. And just this last year in October. And so I conducted the 350-piece marching band in front of 82,000 people doing a medley of my hits. And I don't read music. So I don't play music either. I don't know how I do it, but... Anyway.
You just tell them, like, go play Neutron Dance.
No. You hum things out. You bang pencils on a table.
And they take a chord chart and...
No charts. I wouldn't know how to...
Okay.
No.
But
nothing.
Somebody notates
I don't
this,
write
or?
No, I don't write before I go into record. It's just turn it on and whatever happens. And whether it's that you make sound by tapping against a glass, or a lot of times I'll plunk out the notes on a keyboard and then I use a grease pencil to go 1, 2, 3, 4 and I can hear the rhythm in my head and I just go boom, boom, boom and record a bar at a time. And you do enough of that and you eventually build up a whole record. But
I mean, is anyone approaching to collaborate with you? Because you're here at the conference looking for collaborators. But I imagine every pop musician would want to work with you.
Except that I was here for the interactive part. So the music thing doesn't even begin until... tomorrow. Right.
But you're looking for collaborators on what capacity?
I'm not looking for collaborators. I love to collaborate.
You like to collaborate.
So if I, and because I do a lot of different things and I'm interested in things, it could be a songwriter, it could be a painter, it could be a bug collector, it could be a contractor. I mean, it could really be anything that interests me. You know, a technologist, by contractor I meant, not music contractor, someone who knows how to hammer, nail, and wood
together. Like a carpenter.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I, in fact, regularly do collaborate with a carpenter in L.A. I'm a self-funded artist. I think people think because you've written all these hit songs and blah, 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 you know, you're loaded. But my money has always gone back into trying to reinvent myself. So I really look for anyone that
well,
I can
cutting
get.
Edge of camera equipment. I've just got to say, like that camera was probably released last year or 2 years ago.
Well, it is, except it's still a consumer model. It's not it's a high end consumer model, but it's not like if you really knew what you were doing, that's not the camera.
Well, you know what I like, just to get off topic for a second, these small little consumer cameras, because they're so powerful and so good, they'll go places where the big cameras don't.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's like even document, and people might say, oh, professional and stuff. Most of the stuff that you're seeing in reality TV shows are being shot with these little cameras, not the big ones.
Well, and most of the stuff you're seeing on YouTube is being shot with way less. So in this day and age, you don't need all that stuff. I mean, really anything goes. But I was just saying, if I can see a way to get my expression out via someone that does something else, I don't really care what medium it's in because it makes it more fun for me that no one can really categorize me. Like,
why do you feel like you want to change? So, because you've had so much success in so many things and you've really touched people's lives. Why wanting to change yourself so much? And even like Bubbles the Artist.
Oh, I never
why
talked
hide?
About Bubbles. Shit. Bubbles was... that I had stopped doing music and art because I had a whole separate art career. I'd stopped doing all of it. Emotionally, I'd stopped doing it in 1991. But 1994, the Friends theme was the last song. I wrote that strictly, co-wrote that, to get out of my publishing deal because I wasn't interested in linear art forms anymore. And then it was trying to fund this social network, which people didn't even understand what the internet was, let alone what that concept was. And why would anyone want to see someone's home movies? Or the only people who should be recording are people with record deals. You know, all that like bullshit. And so at the point that I decided, after dealing only with people in the technical community, technology community throughout the 90s, A, I saw not one black person there. And it was so much about you got to become a billionaire. There was no soul at all. This was strictly, this was a quest for control and money, and it made me ill. So at the point that I decided, you know what, I really miss writing songs and painting because I'm around artists, then real artists, not engineers who considered themselves artists.
People who are in it because
they love what they're doing. Whether they make money or not, that's of no consequence. You do it because you have to do it.
Are we seeing a profound transformation?
Well, wait, can I say one thing? Yeah. Just so Bubbles the Artist was created because I loved bad art so much. You know, whatever the art equivalent is of the Del Rubio triplets.
Like macaroni pictures.
Yes, I loved all of it.
Outsider art and those kinds of ideas.
Yeah, and because it was real and it was passionate. And I thought if I didn't know how to get back into songwriting or painting and sculptures and all this stuff I was doing after dropping out for so long. So I thought I've always presented bad art, but I've never been that myself. And the one thing that I noticed among those artists was that they all loved what they did. They didn't bitch and moan like people that have 12 Grammys. You know, they just, their life was about getting up and entertaining. So I thought, what's the least appropriate name for an artist that you would take seriously? And so it was Bubbles the Artist, not just Bubbles, Bubbles the Artist.
No reference to Michael Jackson's pet chimp.
No, no. And, you know, where I tried to do paintings that I did very fast, when I was painting as Allie, these were huge constructions and a lot of motorized pieces. Like, there's a motorized, what have I done to deserve this? And
are people like you involved in the production of popular music anymore today? Because a lot of people are saying that the music industry is so profoundly changed and so missed a boat on the internet that it's no longer an industry.
Well,
anymore.
First of all, I was going around in 1991 to every record company on the face of the earth and going, you know, I don't want to be a songwriter. Let me be your internet liaison. My partner at the time was Prudence. Like, we got off on that. Mm-hmm. And Mark Cuban, do you know Mark Cuban?
The name sounds familiar. Yeah.
He owns the Dallas Mavericks. He he brought streaming audio to the web. In 1999.
He's very enthusiastic, and you see him as a character on The Simpsons, the football, the basketball owner that everybody likes.
Yeah, he's on any show he wants to be on. He was on Entourage. I mean, you know. But he sold the streaming audio company to Yahoo in 1999 for $2.3 billion. Went out and bought the Mavericks the next day. He is a money-making machine. So the three of us were partners. And went around to all these entertainment conglomerates, and we never got taken seriously because they didn't believe that anything could take their place. They were so fucking arrogant. So I've been preaching the downfall of record companies for 2 decades almost.
And we keep hearing over at South by Southwest, and I think you even maybe said it today, is that people just, you can't really make money from music anymore. Is that really true?
No, it's so true. I used to say I'm in the public service industry. You can if you score films and for TV, because then there's actually a contract. You can make a little money with downloads. The way to make money if you're a music artist is performance and merchandise.
Or perform for the rich dictators in third world countries.
Yeah. but again, to me, that's still exploring the art form of the last century. Yeah. So I'm interested in what is music in a digital environment where every person is a potential collaborator.
And so are you going to start making music on this capacity or
I would like to. It's how, I'm
I think it would be so exciting. I mean, I can speak for every listener here out there that it would be terribly exciting to collaborate with you on any capacity, because you're so much of your artistic DNA is in our subconscious, you know, and how we see the, it's kind of hard to separate how we see the world from what impact you've had on all of us.
Wow, could you please write that down? Because that was fantastic.
You can transcribe it.
That's right. See, that's how digital I am. Could you please take a pen and paper?
Do a screenshot. And I speak of that very sincerely. And so, you know, there's a lot of new technologies that are just on the surface about allowing people, for example, to upload a GarageBand file and have another person tinker around with it and then move it on, you know?
Well, the drag of that is that they're looking at 16-year-olds. That's who, you know, God forbid anyone over 20 should have an idea. You know what I mean? You got to be in the line of sight.
It's a generational
of who's
thing.
Developing the technology. Do I think that I could do something like that? Yes, because I've been taking notes for 20 years on it. But I have not met the right collaborator there, but I would kill to meet the right collaborator.
Yeah, hook up with
the
guy who's the 4chan guy who's developing he's developing Canvas. Now I think most of that's going to be kind of like maybe drawing, like I make a cartoon.
Oh, I'd kill
you
for
add
that.
Stuff to it. Yeah. And I'm sure that's the same kind of thing that you're going to be doing.
I mean,
music.
I have literally 20 years of ideas of, and not just ideas where we actually we wrote business plans and we did, you know, about multi-collaborative stuff, but there wasn't the right person to hook up with. Had I been Madonna or even Britney Spears, you would have gotten funded in a second, even though they don't have a fucking clue as to what any of this stuff is. But it's such a star-driven culture, and the people who are funding don't really know the people behind the scenes, you know? So that's always been frustrating. But in a minute, I would kill to do it. I actually discussed that at length with someone today, and we're not sure how we're going to do it, but we're just going to start doing it and putting stuff up there. So I will definitely let you
I think
know.
It's fantastic and deeply exciting.
And let me just say one thing. In building the Allie Willis Museum of Kitsch, which is a social network interface, but again, based around people's collections and crazy things, my kind of general thing was, in the same way that I walked into this house, you didn't need to know anything about me. I didn't need to know anything about you. But because the environment took me, we immediately got on the same level because we had things to talk about because of the way the house was decorated. And I've always maintained that one of the things of being a great party thrower, and I was named number one party thrower in LA by People Magazine. It was a while ago, but I'm serious about parties.
I miss all the good parties.
Oh, my God. But is that if you put people in a plain white room with two windows, that's what you're going to get, a plain white party with two windows. But if you put them in an environment that where there's something to talk about and there's something different, it disarms people. It allows them to be themselves. That's one thing that the web did.
On your social network, so you have people that are belonging to this, and they have their own collection of kitsch that they bring to the table.
And it doesn't even need to be that. You could be in a restaurant, and there's a silly-looking menu, or a tree that's growing funny.
What's the strangest thing that you've seen recently, or somebody that has something that's some kind of collection that you were just like, this even blows my mind.
Oh, I would not even know where to start. I mean, I hand out certificates of authenticity. And also the if it's really incredible, it gets a Classique de Camembert. And but the point I did want to make about it is for a while I went, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? Because I'm basically a curator and a party host there. I choose 10 things a day. Anything you submit is going to get on, because a lot of it is a discussion of what is kitsch, you know. But I choose 10 things a day, and I literally curate and write things about it. And then conversations initially start around the object. Oh, my God, that's the silliest vase I've ever seen. But it eventually gets to, oh, I had one like that when I was a kid. And
you brought back memories, and I can't believe
it. And then eventually you become friends with whoever it is, because you get to know them in a way that's different than just, hi, I'm an accountant.
I'm pulling all my kitsch back out of the box.
You better.
He made me put it away in the basement.
After this, you trust me, you're going to. But what I want to say is, but I thought, oh my God, I'm trapped in this. I have to spend the first few hours of every day doing this.
It gets dusty, though.
But then sure. I realized... No, this whole thing is an art form, mm-hmm. and it's what I do at the parties because I consider the parties an art form. So,
since you're so big on collaboration too, and our show, you know, here at Feast of Fun is a bit of a collaboration too. We have lots of listeners that send us very interesting news articles, and they also post on our website, feastoffun.com/fresh things. And Joanne from Australia sent us this, and I thought it'd be interesting to get your opinion on this because
it's kitschy and sexy.
It's kitschy, it's sexy, and it's very collaborative. And so, UK sculptor Jamie McCartney designed his masterpiece, The Great Wall of Vagina. Now, he was going to call it Design a Vagina, because you remember a few years ago, it was all over the internet in the news that women were getting these vaginoplasties.
Yes, yes. Because
they wanted to get their vaginas rejuvenated.
Yeah, whatever that means.
Whatever that means. And so he put the call out there for women 18 and over to come and have a mold made of their vaginas, and then he put them all together, and he got 400 people to do it. But the one thing he was missing, though, is he got virgins, porn stars, hookers, moms, everybody to do it, except he was trying to find somebody, one of the women that had like one of those clitoridectomies, the genital mutilation from Africa, but none of them stepped forward to do it.
Have you ever seen those photos?
No, but I know all about it because Alice Walker, who wrote the book of The Color Purple. Yeah. That is one of her leading causes to stop that. So
it looks like they just, surgically removed your parts.
No, it's not even surgical. It's the way they describe it, though, is that they'll take the girl outside and it's like anything
sharp. It's hideous.
They don't even use a knife.
No,
broken glass.
And no anesthetic. It's hideous.
Once it heals, though, it looks very unnerving because it's just basically like a slit down there, It's horrifying.
Drawing
attention to the beauty of the human body and certainly drawing attention to an important cause.
And I think that
would be great.
Maybe when I join your network,
I'll put a picture of that up. Definitely. I am an innocent, but I will certainly take a look at that.
It is interesting, though, and something that's come up in this conference is obscene content, because a lot of blogs depend on advertising in order to pay for their hosting bills. If you get up to a certain threshold like we do, we depend on our listener support, advertiser support, in order to present the content that we have to such a mass audience.
Yeah.
And the challenge that we face is negotiating as editors that space, because Google and both iTunes and any major tech company is going to penalize you if your stuff is too edgy or too raw or too obscene.
Yeah.
And so, and somebody's actually thought about the call of creating a Google AdSense equivalent, but for explicit or adult content.
Oh, I love that idea.
Yeah. and it's a thing like any social network struggles is facing, is the idea of, am I allowing this content, this free flow of a creativity and expression? Because kitsch is all about fun and games and joy. But when you open your doors to humanity, you're also opening it up to some really dark stuff.
Well, in my case, first of all, because I'm not, I should be, but I'm not dependent on any of that because I funded myself.
Yeah.
So it really is my vision of what I want it to be. And my stuff is kind of, there's a childlike thing to it. So it hasn't attracted people. There maybe have been a couple things, but you would view it as so tame sexually. It would be crazy.
So the vagina, the Great Wall of Vagina would probably be the most.
Oh, that would definitely be the most out. But the fact that that person had a vision to do that is very interesting to me. And the fact that they put that out there and that they got 400 people to do it is very interesting to me. So I would glorify it on that front, that someone had a vision and they accomplished it, and the joke's on all of us.
It's kind of like Judy Chicago's dinner piece, but
dinner
going a little deeper.
Well, Ali Willis, you know, I could listen to you all night long. This is such a delight and a joy of meeting you and hearing you talk about your remarkable life and future.
And very great to be a guest on your show.
Anytime you want to come back.
And on. I'm impressed at what you guys know. I mean,
oh my God.
No,
how
no.
could you not?
How could I not? Exactly.
How could you not? Okay. Remember, listeners, that today's show would not be possible without your support. Go to feastoffun.com and click the share and save button.
And could we say one thing? Could we spell my name? Because no one will spell it and they'll never find me.
Oh, it's in the ID3 tag.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Anyway, just in case somebody's sitting there.
A-L-L-E-E-W-I-L-L-I-S. So AllieWillis.com and also AWMOK, AWMOK.com, Allie Willis Museum at Kitch.
So just like the Willis Tower. That used to
be
the Sears
Tower. Yes, of course. That has nothing to do with me.
Your new house, Allie. Remember, click the share and save button and share today's show on your social network and introduce your friends to the woman they already knew, Allie Willis. You already know her. You just now know who the person is behind all this wonderful stuff.
Wow.
And I want to thank our delightful friends at LifeLube.org, your gay, sexy, healthy spot on the net. Need health pointers? Ask Peter. Where do I find a gay-friendly church? He'll know the answer. Visit LifeLube.org and ask Peter Pointers your health questions. Gay, sexy, healthy, LifeLube.org.
Do you have any unanswerable health sex questions?
Unanswerable.
I'm not even sure which angle to approach it. Unanswerable. No, I don't think I do.
Because I want people, our audience, to stump Peter.
One last question. So the theme song to Friends. Did you write that as a song and then they took it for the thing, or did you write it specifically as the theme song?
I was trying to get out of my publishing deal because I did not want to write linear songs anymore. And every time I thought it was out, because it was a contract that I had a song quota in, so you had to write like 40 songs a year, which in my past would have been no problem, but not being interested in songwriting at that point was a huge problem. So I owed a seventh of a song because I wrote with so many groups. You could write with two people, but nine people's name would end on the label. So finally they said, there's this TV show that's on the air in 3 weeks. They weren't going to have a theme song. Now they're going to have a theme song. There was some music written. And could you like put a lyric to it? And I thought, if this is going to get me out of this deal, I'm going to do it. And the music, it sounded like a country song. It was like me who's written all this like soul classic stuff. This song is going to kill me. So, but I knew I could get out of the deal. So I did it. And then because there was so little time before the show was on the air, the Rembrandts were the only Warner Brothers group, because it was a Warner Brothers show, that were in Los Angeles at that time. They were the only group that could actually record it at that moment. So they did it, and it was never meant to be released as a record, but there was a DJ in Nashville who made a cassette of it and put it on the air and played it, I think, for 45 minutes straight, just kept looping it. And so then they said, well, we need to now turn this into a full song, which we did. And that's how it was born. I will say, though, it was talk about experiences that can happen to a songwriter. So it became the number one airplay record of 1994, biggest song in 1994. But the group refused to release it as an actual single because there were other writers on this song. I mean, they actually did get writing credit because they added the bridge and wrote some more lyrics. They, I guess, were very resentful that it wasn't quote unquote their song. And then, you know, happens to a lot of groups, you know, your success is based on a lot of people's work, not just your own. And they figured, oh, we're just going to keep having hit records, which was not the case. So the big shot was never taken for anyone. So we didn't make a dime from sales, basically.
Well, why not just team up with you again and release a new album?
Because if you have an ego
that gets in the way,
it's not going to happen. You go, rather than enjoying the success, you go to resenting this.
So that is the final word. If you want to succeed in social media, Don't let your ego get in the
way. Absolutely. No room for ego at all.
And so we're going to leave you here with more favorite, more of my favorite music, the Del Rubio Triplets. Whip it, babies. Whip it good. One of my favorite songs from that album. Ali Willis, it's a thrill and a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank
on
you.
Show.
Thank you both.
Bye, everybody.
Let it down unless you whip it. No one gets away until you whip it. Now whip it. I say whip it. Whip it good. I say whip it. Whip it good. Slip, step on a crack, break your mama's back. A problem comes along, whip it, whip it. The queen sits out too long, whip it, whip it. Something's going wrong, whip it, whip it, whip it, whip it. In the shake, shake it up, get straight, go forward, move ahead, not to the desert, not to the whip it. I say whip it, I whip it. Whip it!